I'm Fathery.
This is Dave.
And this is Text Trek.
Engage.
Welcome back aboard the Starship Texas for the 283rd installment of the Text Trek podcast, the home of Star Trek fandom from deep in the heart of Texas, where we take a deep look at Star Trek, old and new. And tonight, we're talking about Star Trek Discovery, Season 5, Episode 4, Face the Strange, written by Sean Cochran and directed by Lee Rose. I just want to point out that this is the last episode of Discovery for Lee Rose. And Sean Cochran will have a co-writing credit on an upcoming episode, but both of them have been with Discovery since season one, so we're coming up at the end of their contributions to the show.
Seems like appropriate that they got to do a little bit of a little from the present and a bit from the beginning too.
Yeah, give it to some of the vets that were there from day one, so, or at least from season one. Before we start unpacking this episode, I want to give a big thank you and shout out to the Text Trek Patreon supporters who make the show possible. So thank you so much, Starfleet Sohel, Cake is Eternal, Crazy Dutchie, Joanne Robertson, John Daw, Geek Filter, Quark Spar, Stephanie Durantas, Matthew Averett, Braxton, Chuck A, Joel Vallis, Ben Genium, and our anonymous supporters. We couldn't do it without y'all, and to celebrate, we like to have typically monthly Patreon watch parties, but that's going to become weekly for a little bit in the month of May. So it'd be a great time to join the Patreon. You can come in at whatever tier you're able to help out at, but you can come in as little as $2 a month, and that will get you into the monthly watch parties. There's some additional perks as well. Like if you were to join as a Bridge Crew member, you can actually have episode selection on watch parties and get to pick what we watch. And we have a lot of May birthdays, so we're doing 4 watch parties in May with our patrons. Any patron can come, but yeah, we're going to be celebrating Starfleet Sohel, we're going to be celebrating Braxton, we're going to be celebrating Joel and Aaron, so each of them will get a turn at picking the episodes we're watching. I think first up is actually going to be Braxton on May 4th, and we're going to be watching a couple DS9 episodes, if I recall correctly. But yeah, it's going to be a lot of watch parties in May, so I'm really excited for that.
Yeah, Deep Space Nine would be cool, and whenever we catch an episode, it's always cool. We just had fun with your episode, Fathery, which was a movie episode.
Oh yeah, we did Star Trek III, The Search for Spock, so sometimes we watch movies, sometimes mm-hmm. we watch shows. Star Trek gives us a variety, though. Yeah, infinite diversity and infinite combinations. We might watch, who knows, we might watch half of In the Pale Moonlight, and then half of The Trouble with Tribbles, just to mix it up, you know? That'd be some infinite diversity and infinite combinations. I don't know if we'll do that.
I want somebody to pick a piece of the action.
Yeah, you know, I just watched that with my partner that I'm showing Star Trek to for the first time. She's watching all of the original series in production order and is really liking it. And
I particularly hope she liked that one, but that's very cool.
She's even, she wanted to watch with the original effects. She's like, what's this like 21st century CGI bullshit? I want to see how they did it in the 60s. So it's fun for me because I've never watched the original effects Blu-rays on a PlayStation 5, upscaling it to a 4K TV, so it looks better than I've ever seen the original series before. So it looks really good. Like, not even just 4K Blu-rays, but your old school 1080p Blu-rays. If you put them in a PS5, that's actually like one of the best upscalers. So it looks really good. Just saying.
Love those old effects.
I watched the Tholian Web the other night, and you know what? I got to see the actual effects that were nominated for an Emmy. If you watch the version that's streaming on Paramount Plus, you're not going to see Emmy-nominated effects. You're going to see the CGI stuff.
Right. And I do think they did a good job with the CG. It's not a knock on them, but yeah.
So it's funny. It's funny, Dave, you say that. I was just on the cruise with Mike and Denise Okuda, and they were talking about how, like, we didn't want to do that. We thought the effects from the original series should be preserved, but we didn't want someone else to come do the remaster and mess it up. So
yeah, well, I think they actually did a really good service for sort of people who were, you know, basically modern, newer, younger viewers who were going back, helping them, ease them into it, and try something that I think we've all at least wondered about, like, oh, you know, what if you update some visuals in these things? Can it be done? Does it look cool? Can you still reflect 60s visual aesthetics and all that stuff? So I think it's a cool project. But yeah, I gotta admit, I'm glad that I want the original to always be an option. Lucas. Well, I think we have some news stuff to talk about.
Yeah, some unfortunate news, sadly. So John Trimble, who, not as well known as Bijo Trimble, who seems to often, you know, get a lot of the credit, but as she pointed out, John was always, you know, with her by her side, but the half of that pair that was involved with the letter writing campaign that got the original series its third season, that got it enough episodes that it became this big syndication property in the 70s and got in front of enough eyeballs it became a pop cultural icon. But John Trimble passed away this morning. I see TrekCore reporting it on Twitter, and I know like the family have been posting something. So I don't know much of the details, but he has had a long, apparently you know, very healthy life. He was still pretty active in recent years. Two of them were at STLV for the 50th in 2016, and then last year they were at the Picard Season 3 premiere. I think our friends Aaron and Sohel at least saw Bijo there. I don't know if they saw John Trimble there too, but they, I think, got a picture with Bijo.
Well, definitely an honored member of the Trek family.
Yeah, so a pretty important person. You know, the Trimbles were, I think, they were the last essentials of, like, the people who were necessary to make Star Trek the big thing it was. You know, you had the creative side. You know, you had Gene Roddenberry and Gene Koons and Dorothy Fontana and, you know, the actors, the crew, all the people who made the show. But what got it that third season was the letter writing campaign. And without that third season, you know, it wouldn't have been a worthwhile thing to pick up in syndication. You know, who was going to, you know, buy if it was only like, you know, 50, 60 episodes, but, you know, you push it closer to 100, it starts getting picked up and then circulated around. And everyone knows, you know, it was the mainly kids watching Star Trek in the 70s where it really grew and found the fandom, found the audience. So
that's basically my story. I came yeah. in watching reruns in the 70s.
Yeah, who knows if any of us would be, you know, fans making Star Trek content if it wasn't for these fans doing the fan stuff they did back in, what, 1968? So.
Absolutely, yeah. The sort of the patron saints of Trek fandom.
And we have people in our audience who were first-run TOS viewers who participated in the letter-writing campaign. We just talked to Doug Drexler a couple weeks ago. He was a kid watching Star Trek in the 60s and participated in the letter-writing campaign. So I see that. Jill in our live audience right now is commenting that she wrote to the letter-writing campaign. So that's great that we do repeat this story and share it and, you know, honor these people, but also just remind everyone that, you know, the fandom is mighty and that Trekkies can get a lot accomplished. So we can remember the examples of John and Bijo Trimble.
Absolutely.
But there's not much else in the way of news. I guess Rod Roddenberry's lost Enterprise model got found, and now they got it back. So cool.
Saw that. Yeah, that's
Gene's,
that's cool.
Gene's model that got lost. Then it popped up somewhere and it was online on eBay and then it disappeared again. But now they have it. So
I believe it looked like in the photos I saw, like it could use a little restoration. But very cool to have it around.
We just watched The Search for Spock over the weekend in the Patreon watch party. And, you know, remember the Enterprise rolling up into the space dock? And it's all, you know, messed up from fighting Khan. Yeah. But, you know, we still love seeing her come home. So
always. Yeah. Nice analogy. I like that.
I stole that from our friend Sub Commander Tal, who had made a tweet about using that moment from that movie as a reference. But, you know, what a great way to lens it in real life.
Mm-hmm.
But Dave, let's talk about this episode of Star Trek Discovery. Season 5, Episode 4, Face the Strange. I'm just going to quickly recap it by reading the official synopsis, and then I'll expand on that with spoilers. But the official synopsis reads, on the way to the next clue, the USS Discovery is sabotaged by a mysterious weapon, leaving Captain Burnham, Rayner, and Stamets as the only crew members who can possibly save the ship in time. Oh, this is like a ship in time that they have to save in time. So kind of double meaning, double entendre there. But yeah, we had some timey-wimey shenanigans.
Yeah, there was some notable double meanings in, you know, like when she told when Burnham told Rayner that he was in flux.
Yeah.
You know, not missed by me.
Yeah. But they are able to save the day, and while they get the ship unstuck in time, they do discover that they lost 6 hours and apparently lost the lead in the treasure hunt. So we end the episode, you know, the chase is back on, but now Maul and Locke, you know, plot twist, now they're in the front. Now they're in the lead, so.
They had they got a really powerful weapon for some Bonnie and Clyde hoodlums.
Possibly. I mean, we don't really know exactly what the progenitor tech is, or how you would use that as a weapon, or what the Breen are going to do if it's sold to them. We just know that
I just mean the spider.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, you know, there's a great explanation of why that was such a badass weapon, I think. Mm-hmm. But Dave, why don't you give the first opening statement? Just let us know your broad thoughts on this episode before we get into the specifics.
Sure. Sure. I have a question first. I was trying to remember if this is the first era in the personal transporter era. Is this the first transporter malfunction episode? Because that's exciting. I just wanted to call that out. If it is, just it's good to know that the classic tropes live on.
Where like the malfunction is part of the,
yes, like splitting Kirk in two.
Yeah,
not just
I think
they
so.
Can't use
yes,
it, but where it's the plot.
I mean, we saw the transporter not work last week when they stood too close to a rock.
but
the script needed
it
not
up.
To work,
or wasn't integral to it. So yeah, I was excited to see that. No, the actual heart of the episode is the structure, I guess I should say, is a classic Trek tradition, at least having its roots in. Time loops, like a cause and effect. I know it's not an actual time loop, but it plays similarly. It's got a similar vibe to it. And so a little early on, I was a little detached from it because I think I thought, I have seen this before. I do want to see Burnham and Rayner working together. It was pretty clear early on that this was going to maybe be his chance to shine, his chance to turn us around. I want to say, I think maybe opinions no one cares about. One of our the screen name of one of our listeners, I think he may have called it as episode four as the one where it happens, and he was right. But what set itself apart from that, you know, tradition is that once they figure out what's going on, they don't spend too much time. It's more about like, well, what can we actually do about this? It got to this very interesting sequence of Burnham facing off with her original self, the original crew, as they appeared in season one. We saw the confident, mostly healed Burnham of the 32nd century up against that self-doubting, really had something to prove Burnham from the 23rd century. And I loved how that brought into like this very sharp relief the journey that she's been on. That reminded us how she's evolved from the first season. And it was a cool technical achievement, too. Like, I thought it looked really good, all those scenes. But it made me feel like, wow, this really does feel like a final season kind of thing. It's showing her pathway and her evolution in such a cool, clear way. You know, I know that I feel like they must have had some inkling to have done that. Maybe they show something in every season to kind of show character growth and remind us, but that one was like, really felt like a last season kind of thing. But then this was indeed Rayner's episode two to show his worth. It occurred to me, it's a little contrived that, the first thing that Burnham assigned him what to connect with the crew was indeed what saved the day.
Thank God for that conversation about the curves of a 23rd century constitution class.
Yes. I'm still kind of turning it over in my head, but where I can forgive it a bit is sometimes Trek does that. Sometimes it be that way in an hour long structured episode, but yes, a little bit of a stretch there. I think they did show his journey pretty well during the course of the episode of like coming, when you see Burnham firsthand, I think it kind of changes people. It's one thing to kind of hear, oh, she figured out the burn, but he's working directly alongside her, bonding with her. You know, he bonds with Stamets, who, he called like a fellow old dog like himself. And I'm mm-hmm. like, he's a little younger than you, I think. But but I thought that was interesting because he's a little bit of the bridge between Burnham's age and his own. And, you know, it sort of symbolically maybe makes sense that that's how he's kind of part of how he's able to bridge that gap. And he both called on the sort of superficial interview that he did with Reese in the previous episode and the sort of deeper talk with Burnham from this very episode about you know, her feelings in that, you know, circa that first season, coming on board the Discovery. So emotionally, I did feel it, even if there was some contrivances going on. To me, it's another pretty strong episode. I was so happy with the surprise attention to, or surprise focus on Burnham meeting herself. That was a big thing for me.
Yeah, totally. That might have been my biggest, you know, kind of shock reaction moment of watching the episode. But for me, just like overall, this was one that I've been thinking about a lot the last few days, and it was. After I had watched the screener the first time a few days ago, and I can't even remember what I was doing. I was just like doing something like around the house, just kind of like walking around. I was thinking about something in this episode, and it just made me go like, hot damn, I love Disco Season 5. I love how it uses the Trek universe. There were, I guess, like a little few missed opportunities in this episode. Like they could have had it would have been great to see a cameo from either Anson Mount or Jason Isaacs. I would have loved to see Lorca or Pike. I think either one would have been cool, but you know, they're probably, you know, hard actors. I mean, Anson shoots Strange New Worlds like right across the street, right? I think you'd be able to get him, but oh well, I'm a sucker for these temporal anomaly sci-fi stories. We get a lot of them in Star Trek, and you know, I'm often, here for it. I'm one of the time travel story apologists. I'm like, no, like I love like time travel in my science fiction. I think Star Trek should keep doing time travel episodes. I when people say like no more time travel, like to me like that's this crazy saying like no more warp reactors or no more prime director. Like no, that's like one of the staples of the show, of the franchise. You know, it's like a frequent thing that it does, and it does quite well. So I liked that. Like you said, Dave, it was a great thing to do in your final season to show where you'd come from, to show the where you were in the middle and between. They did this with Voyager in its final season with the episode Shattered, and you could say that TNG did it with All Good Things. You know, they show you encounter at Farpoint again in the finale at All Good Things. But I thought this was different enough from both of those. And honestly, there's some stuff in here as far as like how they handle like the rules of the time travel and stuff that like I actually like more. so I think I'd put this over Voyager's Shattered. But I am very, very, very happy with these first four episodes of Star Trek Discovery Season 5, and I'm trying not to get too hyped for the remaining six episodes, but, you know, one of my hopes was that this would be my favorite season of the show, that I would like this even more than I liked Season 4, and so far, it is on track to, I think, be the best, and I probably would have said, like, really great things about Picard Season 2 after its fifth episode. I didn't quite like fall off the Picard Season 2 bandwagon until the astronaut ball in Season 2 Episode 6. So I don't want to say I'm convinced just yet, but I'm excited going into I'm kind of like you, Dave. I know like you get like this nervousness sometimes when like you're really liking something and you're worried that it's you're just waiting for the other shoe to drop, you know, when it's gonna yeah. Piss you off, you know, or when you're gonna like finally like see the flaws rise to the surface and it's you know. So, but hopefully we maintain this and finish the show stronger than ever. But I guess let's go ahead and get into the episode breakdown, you know, starting with the beginning. We get not a ton of Maul and Locke. Dave, one thing I think we both were hoping for a lot of them in the front half of the season, and it looks like unless they give us a lot of them next week, you know, we haven't really gotten too much substance with them. But did I lose Dave? Oh, dear. Well, that's an inconvenience, but that's okay. The show must go on, as they say in show business. So let's get into the episode breakdown. So starting off, we have the deal between Maul and Locke with the goblin man-looking dude. They poison him with the Fapiano poison with the latinum. What, DT, you're saying Dave thinks very little of these two? Oh, is that why he left? He just, like, I was like, Dave, what do you think of Maul and Locke? And then he just left. Well, hopefully I get Dave back. Yeah, he might have got caught in a time cycle by a Critom time phage thing. Matthew Averett, thank you so much for the $5 super chat. Matthew Averett says, I feel like we should get more Maul and Locke since we haven't seen them too much. So the scene that we get here, they're doing the, you know, the shady dealings with the shady deal maker. But I think it's interesting that when they show them do this extreme act of violence and kill someone, they're actually killing someone who sounds like a pretty terrible, pretty scummy person. So I don't know. The show still clearly wants us to root for Maul and Locke on some level. They never show them doing anything like too heinous in these first four episodes. You know, the guy that they kill here, it sounds like he sold chemical weapons used on civilians to the Emerald Chain. But it shows that they're pretty deadly, and that they're, you know, how they'll kind of just nonchalantly do these extreme acts of violence. You know, we saw something similar in the first episode of the season when Locke unloaded on that android Fred after he shot at Maul. Dr. Truffles says, root for Maul and Locke, really? No thanks. That's interesting. But yeah, I think that they're meant to be very, very likable bad guys. Book has that line in that first episode that says, you know, if I didn't hate them, I would like them, or, you know, whatever he says. But I think it's interesting that Maul seems to be the one with the more conviction, more the drive. Locke is saying, like, you know, I'm nervous. It feels like, you know, the walls are closing in on us. You know, do we really need to keep doing this? And she's the one with more of the drive, like, yes, you know, it's necessary. In the first episode, she was the one like, hey, do you want the pebbles or do you want the mountain? So she's the one with like a bit more ambition. I actually like, she's the one that I trust the least right now. I don't know if she's going to have some type of plot twist where they're like, oh, she actually wants this progenitor tech for a specific reason, or I could almost like see her like almost like betraying Locke. We don't really know much about their past, their relationship with one another. I mean, they seem to be really liking each other, but I kind of hope that's the case. I kind of think it would be fun if we had a Spike/Drusilla type villain couple like we had in, talking about the TV show Buffy the Vampire Slayer way back in, I don't know, like 1998, season two, where they introduced these new villains, and they were this couple madly in love with each other who were, you know, very lovey-dovey and affectionate to one another, but just like really nasty to everyone else, it seemed. Dave said he lost internet, but he's trying to get back. But I guess, you know, it doesn't take much for Maul to get Locke back on board with the plan, because, yeah, he does come around when he starts making out with her. So that is the explanation of the time bug, the Krenom time bug. So having that in the show kind of gets the plot started when Adira is on that Skype call with Gray. I thought it was weird. Like, they never show Gray's face. We just hear his voice. And instead, there's like this picture of the two of them hanging out. So I guess like Adira was talking to Gray while looking at this image of like a picture of just the two of them. Hi, Paul Nash. Sorry, Dave's not here. He's having some internet issues. Jill says, Dave doesn't have tardigrade DNA. This explains a lot. I think he might have some tardigrade DNA, but not necessarily the temporal anomaly immunity. He has some of the, like, I think he can't live outside of time, but he can like go into hibernation in deep space. He got that trait. Looks like we're going to have a cameo from Starfleet Sohel. What did y'all think? I'll just talk to people in the audience. After we see Adira's time bug, you know, crawl away and go off to infect the ship, we then cut back to Burnham and Raynor on the bridge being active in this treasure hunt. They've gotten to Zenkethi space. They don't see anything. And Raynor kind of shoots down Reese. Reese suggests, oh, maybe the two of them all unlock. Maybe they're just like going to lay low and see what we do. And it's dumb for us to sit around and wait for them because they're probably sitting around waiting on us.
Hey there.
Hey there, Starfleet Sohel.
I sabotaged Dave just so I could make this cameo and be on with you. I put a time bug in his house.
happy to have you here.
I'm gonna keep you company so you can do this show, and I'll do the engineering like Dave usually does.
tell me what did you think of Raynor's kind of shutdown of Reese and then Burnham being like, yeah, let's go talk about this in the ready room?
You know, I definitely thought like Raynor was, you know, being a little too direct or whatever, not the style that we're used to, you know, on Disco and stuff like that. And then I loved Burnham takes him into the ready room, and then she's like, you know, I want my crew to feel, you know, be able to talk freely and stuff like that. And then he's like, well, okay. And then he gives her a piece of mind, but he goes over the line. But what I really liked is that he realized it and he like backs up and he's like, okay, sorry, like I shouldn't have done that. You know, I went over the line. So Raynor's such a great character, and I'm really enjoying him more and more every week. I think he's really cool.
I've really enjoyed Raynor. I like that he did get like a little like pissy with Michael when he's like, you know, when she's like, you're in a state of flux. And he's like, ah, don't give me the, like, you know, what did he say?
BS.
Like the,
he said, yeah, like don't the give touchy, me that BS.
Like, yeah, the touchy-feely BS, or like, I understand you. But then after that, like, he kind of like backed down. And he kind of, backtracked and saw the error of his ways. So I thought that was very real. That's kind of how, you know, in real life, when people mess up, they kind of, you know, go a little too far before they realize it.
I mean, he's in a tough situation, like, because he was the captain of a ship for, like, 30 years or something like that. That's what he's used to, right?
As Aaron saying in the live chat.
Yeah, I'm sure he's used to being captain. So it's hard to, exactly, this is the point I was going to make. It's hard to unlearn the type of conversational style where you're in control, absolutely, 100%, yeah.
But let's talk about, like, our timey-wimey stuff. Like, you know, they're having this conversation, and I guess just because, like, they tried to beam right when the bug activated, but because of that, they don't get quite as stuck. I guess they're slightly less stuck in time as the rest of the ship. It's like, they're still stuck in the time jumps, but they're able to be aware of what's going on. But yeah, and then all of a sudden they're back, and oh, we're back in, like, season 3, episode 2. We're crossing over into the 32nd century, and Detmer's about to crash the ship, and Rainer is kind of the fish out of water in this. You know, he doesn't know the history of the ship. He doesn't know the history of the show. So as he's kind of experiencing all of this again, we get kind of a Discovery recap, you know, just not necessarily a recap, just some reminders of, you know, this is where we came from.
Yeah, it's a cool take on doing flashback shows or clip shows, you know, like, it was neat because we're seeing moments that we're familiar with if we've been watching Discovery since season 1, or, you know, if we know what's going on, but just from a slightly different perspective. And I love the Rainer, like, take on, like, you know, he's just like, it looks like we're in a wormhole, but then Burnham's like, oh yeah, no, that's the angel, that's me, they're following me through. I also like that they were all passed out here just like they were in that episode, and then they leave the room and you hear Saru say that they're about to crash land. So it's like, every, you know what I mean, like, they just missed everyone while they were unconscious, like, mm-hmm. So no one knows the wiser. What I liked about this Krenim chronophage is that if they hadn't, other than Stamets, Burnham, and Rainer, like, it's a really neat kind of weapon, if you will. It just throws you on this loop for, like, hours or days or weeks, even, I think he was saying, and no one's the wiser. When you come out of it, or when you're rescued from it finally, you're just, like, missing time. But since they were out of the out of phase with that, and they were aware of all the temporal changes, we got to see this really cool kind of, like, perspective where they keep getting like reset to this location, and now we're on the scene that you're showing, which is the second jump that they did, which is back to the San Francisco Naval Yards where Discovery was constructed.
And I loved seeing it in the Golden Gate Bridge in the background, and I was like, I bet someone's gonna bitch about them, like, building the ship on Earth, and I don't know, I'm glad that that person's gonna be frustrated, because I think that's I think there's no reason why it can't be. But
just a sidebar, Father, it's so cool that we had just kind of, like, talked about this on our animated series discussions when Robert April was talking about how Enterprise was built at the San Francisco Naval Yards. And I imagine this is where it was built.
Yeah.
Like the same place. It's pretty cool.
I mean, Gene used to explain that as it was actually in geosynchronous orbit with San Francisco, and it was, like, in space. But maybe they have, maybe they build some of the stuff on the ground and then take it up there. Maybe they have, like, an orbital lift thing going on. Like, you don't know, like, there's no reason why it couldn't. Well, I guess if there was an orbital lift in San Francisco, we would see it in all those like wide shots of San Francisco they do. But it was fun to see, like, that construction dude, and he's just like, he sees, like, these 32nd century uniforms, but I guess he's just like, oh, you know, Starfleet changes uniforms all the time, so who the hell knows? I guess I haven't seen these before. But what Rainer has all these, like, old, outdated, like, human phrases that, you know, he tried using one on Tilly last week, and she kind of reacted like she didn't even know what he was talking about, what he was referencing. But the thing that he says to the construction dude, what is it? Prepare to fail to prepare. And then he says, I hate that saying. I've never heard anyone say that before.
I've never heard it either, yeah.
I'm sure now I will notice it all the time, but I don't know. If I've heard it before, it never stuck. I just never knew that was a thing.
Yeah, that was pretty funny. I like that he's kind of awkward, which reminds us that he's an alien, and I like that a lot.
The Kelleran? Yeah, I want to get some Kelleran culture. He just seems like he just seems like a human from the 20th century. But I loved the buddy adventure element of Burnham and Rainer having to, you know, solve this thing together. And I liked them kind of developing their teamwork rapport, kind of their working dynamic, you know, when they're having to problem solve and piece things together. And you see, like, their different styles kind of come together. By the end of the episode, they're much more on sync. I think they're a better Captain Exo duo. You know, they're closer to like that, you know, that Kirk Spock kind of thing where they're just so in sync.
Their chemistry and their rapport is so good that it's making me feel even worse that Disco is ending after this season, because I'm like,
is it bad though? Is it bad or is it good that like they end on like a really strong season? Like what if this is a great season and then next year they stumbled hard, you know? I kind of want them to like go out on a good note.
That is the silver lining there, Fathery. It's true. It looks like they're going to end on a very strong season. It's true.
My theory is that Doug Jones wasn't going to last more than 5 seasons, and so Rayner was just going to be the replacement first officer, and if there was a season 6, it would have been Michael and Rayner without Saru.
Legit. But you're absolutely right. It looks like they're setting up to go out really strong, so that is a silver lining, but it just gives me FOMO, like wanting more.
But I get what you mean. It's like, shit, I'm only gonna see 6 more episodes of the show. Like, they're doing so good. Like, I wish it was 60. But The introduction of Stamets into the story, when Burnham remembers, like, oh yeah, my buddy Paul, he's immune to this temporal stuff because he's got the tardigrade DNA. I liked Rayner's reaction to that when Burnham's just like, yeah, Stamets, he lives outside of time because he has tardigrade DNA. It's just like Rayner's like kind of mad, but he's just like, he kind of like groans when he hears that.
like, because he's already like, you know, he comes from like a very like different environment, as Burnham points out, like, you know, and him as well, like when he's talking about like, you don't know what it was like to be in the burn. And it reminds me of season 3 when we were all kind of like, wow, these poor guys, like look at how the Federation is, look at how everyone is and stuff like
so
that.
So dire.
So dire. And to me, like that reaction by Rayner, it's kind of like more of a kind of like an echo of that, just showing the difference. Like, here's these guys from the 23rd century who are like doing weird stuff with science and getting, you know, getting involved with tardigrade DNA and just like optimistic as hell and like can do and never give up and like, you know, this kind of attitude and not suspicious as much, you know, and not like as kind of you know, jaded, if you will. So I like that I like that Discovery, you know, is, and the crew can change people who have been through the ringer, if you will, have had hard times, and kind of like remind them that maybe there's a way, there is another way. Like, there are always possibilities. I love that line from Spock, you know?
Yeah. And people do change. I mean, like this episode, if anything, it shows like there has been, you know, growth and development on Discovery. But you know, one of the things about having Rayner around as the, you know, the older dude, who's a bit more experienced, at least for the 32nd century, you know, having lived through the burn. So even though Michael was a bit more on the ball about what was going on, and, you know, Rayner was thinking like, well, what if this is not temporal? What if it's like something in our mind or something? But it kind of took like the two of them working it out. But then eventually Rayner was like, ah, I got it. Crinum time bug. You know, and there's no way Michael would have known about that. You know, probably like she probably hasn't dealt with as many relics of the temporal war that this guy who's lived his whole life in the 32nd century has, but he still needed her to help, you know, guide him. So he's, you know, kind of like that good teamwork, good collaboration, and that kind of carries through. That's even something Burnham eventually articulates to both Rayner and the audience, but it takes a village. So there's a big like teamwork component to this story. Dave has reemerged from his temporal time cycles.
You got Crenum chronophage, Dave.
I did. There was seems like just a straight up internet outage.
No, that happens.
Sohail, I'll also move you to step in.
Yeah, and I'm actually going to dip, guys. See you later.
Dave, let's talk about like after Stamets comes into play in the episode. Yeah. You get kind of like the teamwork between Burnham and Rayner and Stamets, but first of all, just like getting the party together, you know, just finding Stamets. It's inconvenient because every time that there's like a temporal reset, Michael and Rayner go back to the ready room, and then Stamets goes to wherever he is because he's just staying in his same body. So there's only like one Stamets, but there's gonna be like multiple Michaels, and so like the rules kind of like work differently. But I don't know. I thought it was all like really well explained. At least like I understood. It all made sense to me.
I think for longtime viewers, just knowing that he had the tardigrade thing, I think that sets it up just fine. I mean, we understood that he's kind of above we mere mortals as far as these things go. I loved Stamets' participation in it and getting to call on his kind of irritability from season 1 and use it as an asset to just clear the room.
Yeah. Dave, you and I, like, we're both big fans of, like, the regulator shotgun phasers or disruptors or whatever they are. But, like, there's flat rectangular guns that the Emerald Chain regulators have. We have to see some of those in action when Raynor and Burnham are fighting Bucketheads with Reno. So we got Bucketheads. That's the other Star franchise. I don't know if people know that, but, like, the other Star franchise says that a lot, talking about, like, their bad guys who do wear a lot of buckets on their heads, but... I guess that's one of ours now. We're gonna reclaim that.
Had they not used that at any previous time? These were, what are these, Osiris goons? Or yeah. Are these control? Okay, Osiris goons, yeah. Yeah, it was nice to see a little, in a kind of a high concept episode, I think having some action, you know, a good fist fight, not a bad idea. Weirdly, in a lot of ways, this reminded me sort of things that I could feel happening in TOS. Where there's like, oh, we think we've solved the problem, but there's another problem. You know, in the Doomsday Machine, when they're trying to, you know, Scotty's trying to get the engines up and running on it, and there's all this suspense and pressure. It reminded me of stuff like that. And yeah, this gave a little break, and we got to see that Raynor can, you know, he's got a captain's ability to throw down.
And we get that meeting between Reno and Raynor that... I guess now happened in season 3 in like an unseen part.
But doesn't it all get undone? Isn't that the...
That one does not get undone. The only one that gets undone is the last one, where they break the warp bubble.
Ah, okay. That's a little time travel wrinkle like that is fun for Trek. I wonder if they will revisit it in the next few episodes.
I doubt it.
Yeah, it's probably too much of an insider thing. Father, were you pretty happy with Reno's sardonic guest appearances here?
I really liked the use of her in this episode, but I like the stuff with her and Stamets more than the stuff with her and Raynor. But I'm curious if they're going to build on the stuff between her and Raynor. I would like to see more of that friendship between like the two of them. I think they would actually get along.
Father, I see in the audience people are saying what I thought, which is that everything gets reset.
That's not what the dialogue in the episode said.
I thought it did. I thought that somebody, well, I know somebody told Burnham that if this goes through, this will, so, or maybe tells.
That Stamets was the last attempt where they were going to destroy the bug. That one would get undone is what they said in that turbo lift.
Anyway, they never
say 100% that the other ones don't get undone, but the dialogue in that scene is specifically talking about, that's why they only have one attempt, because they have to be so careful not to do anything that breaks the timeline. But but to stop the bug, they're going to have to break the timeline. But if they start breaking the timeline to deactivate the bug and successfully deactivate it, then their breaking of the timeline will be erased and that won't matter.
Got it. I mostly got it.
And I loved those rules because that meant, unlike Generations... See, that would always piss me off in Generations, where it's like, if that didn't work, couldn't Picard just, like, and Kirk just, like, try, like, again and again and again? So I like that they threw in that line here. It's like, no, you only get one shot.
Yeah, I think Generations had the kind of mainstream audience approach, which was that if we just say it, people will just accept it, and they won't think overly much about it. And so, yes, arguably, they put a little bit more thought into these kind of things, even though, as Joel points out, still a lot of timey-wimey going on. But, yeah, it's a... there's a certain, if you're kind of consistent with your own rules, it certainly feels less like magic.
They did a very good job being, that's why I like this more than the Chakotay episode of Voyager Shattered, because I think the rules in that don't work. And I don't like the ending in that, where it's like when Janeway's like, and I knew about this all along. And it's like, no, I much prefer the ending that we get here. But what do you think when they go to the dark future, where the Breen go crazy on Starfleet HQ?
That's I guess when we know how badly things could turn out, and it seems to confirm that the Breen are lurking in the background as the big bads of the season. In as much as there are big bads, you know, Locke and Maul are antagonists, but they're not like, it's not like they're trying to hurt, you know, Discovery directly or anything like that. But it does seem like they might sell to the Breen. So, yeah, I thought this was a good consequences moment. I would expect it to be referenced in the previously on, in every subsequent episode, I bet, from now on. Because it's showing how bad things could get.
They had to do something, I guess, to escalate the stakes in their larger arc. They felt that they needed to do something here. It puts us in an interesting situation. While you were gone, I commented on how Maul and Locke, you know, we see them violently murder someone, but it was also someone who, like, sold chemical weapons to be used on a civilian population, which, you know, it's like, no one's going to grieve the loss of that guy.
But they were like, I guess they were kissing at least at one point while this was he was having his death rattle, which was a little bit more natural born killers than Bonnie and Clyde, you know.
So it shows that they are willing to be like pretty deadly, but they're not like total assholes. And even here, it's like, you know, they're not. I guess in order for the show to maintain like this likability with the two villains, they can't show like the two of them are gonna, you know, wreck Starfleet. So they have to have like the Breen as like the actual monster, so that they can have like their likable baddies as well.
Yeah, I like that. I like them being in that place, and I've liked it from episode one. So I don't want them to turn out to be pieces of shit. You know, I like them as outlaws. They are dealing in like if you get progenitor technology and you sell it to a conquering force, you are implicated. You do have to pay the price for that. I think if you have if money is all that it means, and you'll sell to Hitler, then you know you might as well be in league with Hitler at that point. So that will I'll need a little bit more on that as the season goes along to maintain their likable outlaw status.
They kind of tease a Breen ship. I wanted to see like the 32nd century Breen ship, but there's something like glowing green, and Michael is even like, is that a Breen ship? But they never give us a good look at it. So I think they're teasing. We're going to get a better look at the Breen later in the season. I hope that we still maintain some of the Breen mysteriousness, but I keep hearing people talk about like the theory that I think I've mentioned on the show before, that Locke might be revealed to be a Breen. We don't know what he is, and we don't know what the Breen are under their masks. We know he doesn't like to wear a helmet, so he might be like the odd Breen who is okay being unmasked.
Yeah, maybe there's something unique about him. The weird thing to me is they are doing such a big thing, right? These two people are matching one of the flagships of the Federation in chasing down this goal. It's a, you know, like one of the biggest. It's a red. What do they call it? A red what?
Red directive.
Red directive. And yet they're kind of holding their own, and I'm like, they're talking, their hopes and dreams are to, like, not be hunted and stuff like that. And I was like, I don't know if this is the best path to that, like, if stealing the biggest treasure
in the
world.
That was Locke's argument when he's like, you know, I don't know if this is worth it, you know, maybe.
Right.
But she's like, no, this will buy us, like, the ultimate freedom. When you were gone, I suggested that she might have, like, another motive. Maybe she's just using Locke or something. She does seem to be, like, the more ambitious one. In the first episode, right, she was the one who told him, like, are you going to settle for pebbles or do you want the entire mountain?
Right. I'm a little worried that it's going to escalate, you know, they're obviously badass thieves, you know, like, top courier types, probably, in their kind of dangerous section of it. But, like, you know, it's like stealing the Manhattan Project or something like that in order to, you know, make your big score. Or, you know, do they want to use the technology to cure? Maybe he's, you know, maybe somebody has a sickness. Maybe he's dying of something. Maybe she's dying. I don't know.
I see a lot of people who think, yeah, some people think, like, I guess because his face was kind of weird in the first episode when he first takes off his helmet. Is that why people think he might be sick?
You know, I only thought that because I'm like, what would progenitors technology with like life enhancing power abilities? Why would, you know, they want that in particular?
But
you know,
I don't
over a bank.
But that's just what they came across. That's just what they found on that Romulan ship. I don't think they knew it had anything to do with the progenitors.
I think that's true. But yeah, I'm like, I'm just trying to figure out why, you know, I mean, other than for the sake of the story, why they're, again, stealing the equivalent of the Manhattan Project just to get a big score or something like that. It does seem like there's got to be something better, like less risky than that. Hmm. And I feel like you probably would still be hunted after that.
Yeah, I mean, it looks like they sell to the Breen. So I think that is all they want is like the big score. Unless this is going to turn out to be some type of a misdirect where like Michael's assumption is incorrect. And that's, I don't know. Maybe she's trying to cure her boyfriend and the Breen take the progenitor tech from her. I don't know. But like, I think they are just trying to get the big score.
When I was thinking about it, and this is a little bit of a worry because of that, you know, Discovery trend towards big reveals, I was thinking about like Tarka revealing, oh yeah, I really want to blow up the DMA and do all of this because I want to use the power from it to go to another universe to be with my ex. And that's kind of a big scale thing to do. it starts to stretch credulity a little bit, but that's just speculation at this point. So we shall see.
But Aaron's saying if she's related to Booker, could she be wanting to restore her people, since we know that it can bring dead people back, apparently. But she's related to Cleveland Booker the Fourth, who's Book's mentor. He's Cleveland Booker the Fifth. So the guy she's related to wouldn't be from Quajon. So I think it's something. But I think that will be a temptation for Book. I think at one point Maul and Locke are going to be like, hey, Book, you should help us. Maybe we can bring back Quajon. And we'll have to see what choice Book makes. But speaking of Book, they do have like that run in with Helm when they put the plan in action. They have to get the part from Michael's holodeck. So does only the captain's quarters? Is that like the only quarters that has their own holodeck? I guess
that's, or maybe it's so cool. Like tech is so good that everybody's got it at this point. Or maybe the officers.
Why did they have to? They had to steal it from Michael's quarters, though. So
yeah. Maybe it's like you think it'd be less so that the captain can just have the wackiest fun times, and maybe it's meant to be more like, oh, you can call up such awesome strategic command.
Right, I think it's more like having meetings, like if like an admiral needs to have like a briefing with you or something like that.
Right, right. That makes some sense to me.
But we get like the encounter with Book, which I thought that was fun. You know, I don't want them to do too much, like the will they get back together, won't they get back? I mean, I think that I want them to get back together. But I appreciated last week how they didn't just play up the awkwardness of, like, the two of them. It's like, oh, my ex that I still have, like, a lot of feelings for, and it's going to be hard for us to work together. Can we do this? Can we just be co-workers who aren't in a relationship? And I'm glad that they didn't lean into that too much last week when we saw them go on an adventure with Colbert. You know, they still weren't, like, the same dynamic duo that they used to be, but they had like a decent working relationship there without the baggage of the awkwardness. And then I thought here with like the time travel shenanigans of putting Michael in this really fun, dramatic situation where she is already broken up with him, but this is Book of the Past. He's just like, oh yeah, I can just like casually walk up to you half naked and start sucking face. Like, you know, we just do this all the time.
Right. And he easily dropped the L word.
Yeah. That had to be so hard for her. That's so hard.
Yeah. And then, the sense you get is that it really came flooding back to her. Like, that she was like, oh, man, when we connected, we connected. And, yeah, there's not really quite an experience that equates to this in real life. But people have for sure gone back to exes and found there's something there. Maybe it's still not healthy. Maybe they were for each other. You know, people get back together and get married or stay married, and like all sorts of, you know, relationships can continue. So it reflects that, at least, even if, yeah, we haven't literally time traveled back to like when things were hot and heavy before. But I kind of like its symbolic representation of that. And I feel sure that this seems to be setting them up on a path to reconnect. I mean,
I certainly hope so.
There's no doubt.
I mean, I'm partially worried because in episode 2, Saru said, Michael, you need a first officer like Book. So I'm really terrified the season will end with him in a Starfleet uniform and him and Michael being like, well, I'm glad that we agreed to not be in a romantic relationship because we're going to be captain and first officer and just be platonic buddies on the Discovery. And that's how the show is going to end. I really, really, really don't want that. So I'm hoping that's not where we go. I'm hoping that Rayner is actually the, you know, replacement first officer.
I think Rayner's going to go.
Okay. That's not what, what's his name? Callum Keith Rennie has been saying that.
Behind the scenes, yeah.
If there had been a season 6, he would have. But we know that they reshot stuff at the ending, and I really don't want them just like kill him off, just have like a dramatic ending to his arc.
You know, I think that hand thing of his, I think that storyline is not done yet.
That his hand got old and then got fixed?
Yeah, I feel like there's going to be like something that wasn't altogether fixed about it, because that was such an unusual
thing. When he
thing.
Showed it to her, though, and he was like, look, I'm good as new, like,
right. Okay. I think it got checked on, and I think, you know, Colbert did some stuff, but I just feel like it's, I don't know why you do that scene if you don't intend to kind of somehow follow up on it. He had already made his peace with
her. I was going to save this for the Gorn eggs, but, you know, in the TNG episode Timescape, Picard's hand gets, like, super aged, and the doctor has to cure it. But, I mean,
So you think it might just be, like, a little nod to that?
I mean, yeah, I never watched Timescape and saw that and thought it was, I mean, they didn't really, like, set up things for future episodes on TNG, so it wouldn't have been that anyways, but.
You know, this is obviously more serial than that. I just, to me, it feels like one of those Chekhov's gun things. Basically, when they got back, they could have just gone to the bridge exactly as they were. They had learned, he had kind of learned his lesson. She had learned to work with him. he didn't need to go and see Colbert or have any after effects from it. So I think there's something there. I don't know what.
So the reason why that thing was even a thing, you know, I guess let's talk about like the plan complication and you know, why they only get like one shot to go about this. So if it hadn't had like this little shield on there, it would have been like all of this would have been like much easier. Because of the shield, they have to do like the crazy thing of breaking the warp bubble. So I think that is actually the reason why you made a big deal about the hand, is just so you could have like this escalation of the stakes. You were talking about like this reminding you of the original series. This part reminded me of the original series, Dave, because I think that show had like a very good understanding of having some type of like escalation in the third act, you know, just to ratchet up the drama. And the sci-fi science they come up with here is that there's a shield around the bug, and anything that enters that shield is going to be super accelerated through time. And so by breaking the warp bubble, if the ship's at warp, they're bringing in some real life physics and relativity of like, if you're moving through space so fast that you move through time slower. So they're going to use like the two of these to cancel each other out. So I think the whole idea of like the fast aging hand was just to have some type of visualization of why they would have to break the warp bubble.
Well, I also think it gave Rainer an opportunity to like, he put himself at risk. You know, he showed that he was willing to sacrifice something, even though, you know, that's the kind of thing that, you know, you don't know you're going to survive.
And it also shows like, oh yeah, like being old is like, it's painful. It's like, but it's something that like, you know, like aging. Yeah, it does like wear you down. But it's something, you know, we all have to endure, I guess. But yeah, just like the fact that they're able to like just take time to explain that and be like, but you know, because of this, we only get one attempt. And I don't know, I just thought it was like, okay, it was like well thought out time travel rules, and it's like good dramatic action. And okay, this is the one time where we can go crazy. We can break the temporal prime directive. We can go, you know, tell everyone on the bridge exactly what we're doing, because if it works, we will undo it. But you know, if it doesn't work, then we've totally fucked up the timeline.
You know, it's interesting, like, these time bugs must have been, like, when people use them, they must have been really effective. They said you could be bouncing around for weeks or months.
Yeah. So what does it look like to everyone else? I think if someone activates that on your ship, you know, you don't know that you're bouncing around through time, but if anyone else, like, comes by your ship, if they try to, like, beam on, then they're gonna, you know, they're gonna see all the weird time-jumping craziness, so...
Yeah, for sure. Like, I don't know what you would say. Would they just disappear?
Because in the dark future, they say that, you know, Starfleet eventually found the Discovery and got you unstuck.
Okay, yeah. But, like, you've got, like, some pretty peak officers working on it here, including Stamets, who essentially has superpowers. And they barely got out of it.
Yeah.
Like, if you were just one of the people who this was used on without those level of resources, you were probably screwed, yeah. Man.
That's the 31st century was crazy. You know, like Daniels from Enterprise, the Federation was more advanced before the burn, when like this temporal war was going on. So it's cool to see like even like this, you know, like the remnants of that war. This, you know, this little thing you buy on the black market, it can still do some devastation.
And, you know, speaking of like, you know, so Rainer grew up in the, you know, in the shadow of that. That was his whole life. So we definitely can understand why, you know, he might be somewhat the way he is. But I did notice Burnham made at least some concessions to him about how the overfamiliarity among the crew could, I forget what she said, not breed laziness, but like they could get what, complacent or something maybe?
Yeah, the familiarity can lead to complacency, which I'm not necessarily, yeah. Like, I don't even know if I definitely think complacency is a concern, but I don't know, do you get complacent when you're just like too familiar with one another?
Well, you know, I know that like, way back when, you know, when I'm watching the TNG and I had that love-hate thing going on, and what's his name? I'd see like an episode with Barkley and them having to struggle to make things work for him. And I was like, oh my God, they're right. Yeah, Barkley sucks. He should be drummed out. What is he doing in this organization? You got some standards to live up to, Barkley. And like, I can appreciate much more now that they made an effort to accommodate him and find out how best he can serve and all of that stuff. But there's been times when I was younger, when I was the viewer who was thinking that, you know, yeah, that, you know, I don't want a crew that's like a huggy family. And that's an often levied criticism, I would say, against Discovery, is that, you know, some people, especially old school fandom, found it too touchy-feely. So he's voicing those concerns, and I think Burnham acknowledging that is at least a reasonable point that, you know, it's like, yeah, it could be taken a little too much.
The big moment in this episode for a lot of people was the Burnham versus Burnham confrontation.
Yeah. Man, that looks so good. Like, just visually, we've got a screenshot up of their elevator confrontation here. It really visually cemented it for me.
It's kind of a visual, I don't know, depiction of the show's history. You know, we went from this this very angry woman in season one who thought she had totally, like, ruined her life and ruined the universe. And then, but now she's this cool badass captain of the ship that we all like.
What would you in that state think of somebody telling you things are legit going to get better and all that? And you're just like, no, not a chance. She's like, we're doing this. You know, we're fighting. I love those scenes. I was the highlight of the episode for me, easily. And again, there is a little bit of technical stuff going on in there that just wowed me. So that was impressive, too.
I like that Michael's nerve pinches kind of suck. Like, people, like, wake up from them. Because it's my headcanon that, like, the reason why she's able to do that is because, like, her mind meld with Sark. She's got, like, part Vulcan Katra floating around in her brain. And she can, whatever Vulcan technique is done to make someone go to sleep when you pinch them just right. Like, she's able to do that because she's got, like, a little bit of Sark in her brain, but not enough that she makes them take, like, a long 4-hour nap. They're only down for, like, 5 minutes and they get back up. It happened to Giorgio. It happens to this Michael, but it does give her time to get on the bridge and talk to them while Rayner and Stamets are dealing with the bug in engineering. And that's where we get the Rayner actually does what Burnham says and, you know, learns to connect and show, I don't know, that level of interest, that level of engagement, connection, empathy. But he seems to benefit from it, too. But, you know, when he tells Stamets, let's show them a couple of old dogs still know the best tricks. He's like, you like me, too, right? Like, I'm saying you can be my buddy, but I get to be your buddy, too, right? It almost seemed like he kind of was enjoying the bonding.
Yeah. Yeah, a lot of times when he smiles, it's kind of a grim smile mostly, or like kind of sardonic, a little bit sarcastic. And here he like actually seemed like it, like there was some warmth to it, right? You know, that kind of like he had a little bro moment with him.
Yeah. Dave, you and I had a conversation off mic recently about like when movies do bad lying, and you're saying how like, oh yeah, like normally when people lie, you know, in real life, it's like it's not that hard to sound like you're telling the truth when you're lying. But in a lot of movies and stuff, you see like really bad lying.
Right. They intentionally stammer, and it's meant to for us, the audience, to show. Yeah, what a kind of awkward moment it is.
I thought all the fake lying in this was pretty... Like, when Stamets is like, I'm really angry and I want everyone to get out of here. It's like, okay, he did sound like someone who's, like, kind of acting, who was kind of lying, but it was still... Like, it wasn't, like, so fake, like, it wouldn't be believable, you know, if you heard that, you know? Or yeah. Even, like, with him and Reno, I thought that was, like, pretty good. When Reno is just like, Stamets, are you in a time loop? And he's trying to play it off. He's like, what? No. I was like, okay, I thought that was, like, pretty good. I thought it was, like, that seems like someone actually handling that.
Father, it had a little bit of that sort of slightly exaggerated style that they mentioned about, like, that are in a lot of movies for comedic effect. But because Stamets has been kind of so mercurial in how, like, the spores have affected him and the tardigrade DNA and everything, it felt like it wasn't too big a stretch. Like, the people around him were probably used to him having a little bit some... these flights of fancy and, you know...
Or even Michael. When Michael told Book, I have to be somewhere in 4.5 minutes, I was like, okay, if that was, like, really urgent on your mind, like, shit, I have to get back to Deck 13 in 4.5 minutes, like, you would say that. But then the person you're saying it to would be like, 4.5, that's oddly specific. And you'd be like, shit, that is oddly specific. You know, I thought that was, pretty good.
Father, in the comments, I saw that Jill felt like that Burnham was, like, maybe caricatured would be the way to put it, as far as like past Burnham, and she wasn't like this, like, just all angry person or something.
GL47 in the live audience says, I just don't like this part. Season one Burnham was diminished in this ep for a fight scene. She was not angry or one dimensional in season one.
I know Jill has a lot of fondness for that season one and was saying that Burnham in those, like, in the actual episodes, this is meant to fall between, isn't, like, in a particularly angry mode. I'll say this. I think that they are drawing a little bit on, like, she's kind of representing the difficulty she was going through in this almost more like in the first episode or two, is I think what they're reflecting.
I mean, we know exactly when this episode takes place.
Right. But I think that there's a little stylization. I think it's not meant to maybe be exactly where Burnham was in those moments, but to represent broader first season Burnham, who I do think had a lot to prove. And I'll say this, Burnham has always, even up to the present time in the 32nd century, sometimes acted dramatically. Sometimes Burnham jumps in. And if she's worried that there's a shapeshifter on her ship, I can see her thinking, I'm going to knock this person out and then figure it out. Do you think that, do you think Burnham was too... I guess, I don't think either of us thought she was too caricatured, but, do you think Jill has a point?
Yeah, she did get, really aggressive immediately, but I guess that was a reaction to the, a shapeshifter impersonating her. But as far as, at a time when she specifically, is dealing with a lot, and...
Sure.
Was also really angry at herself. So thematically, I think it works brilliantly of just like, oh yeah, this is the Michael who hates herself. So of course she's going to attack herself with, so I thought it was actually very appropriate to see the modern, just on a thematic level, just to see the modern Michael, the Captain Michael Burnham that we saw evolve over the course of the show, be the target of the Michael we had in early season one, who hated herself.
Right. I agree. Thematically is where this really rings true to me, even if it's not exactly where maybe the character, as she was depicted between episodes 4 and 5 or wherever it was. So yeah, I haven't revisited season one in a while, but I feel like it reflects thematically the Burnham of the era. Yeah. And do we want to talk about Arium here?
So when Michael's on the bridge, Arium's in command. They said that Lorca and Saru are on an away mission. And in season one, Arium was the second officer of the ship. So that makes sense.
I kind of forgotten that.
Yeah, she had the rank of a full commander.
Yeah.
But it's not the season one actor. It's the season two actor. But that's okay. But yeah, they also they bring in Bryce. I thought that Michael choosing to show Michael is such a good captain that she even in this situation, she would still know how to command this crew and doing it through Arium. That was an interesting choice because Arium was a character that I think a lot of us kind of felt like we were forced to like and then say goodbye to in the same episode. But here they kind of expand on that. They give Arium something else good to do. It's Michael is such a good captain. Even the one person on the crew that she never got the chance to command, Arium, who died before she could make it to the 32nd century with the rest of them. But Michael still had the good leader instinct to know if I can convince Arium, the rest will fall in line behind her. I just thought that was that's a nice little subtle good insight shows that she's got the captain merit, the captain brain in action.
I really liked it. I like that too, and I thought it was a neat sort of, post-death moment for Arium to be able to kind of, it's a sad but sort of pivotal scene of insight and helping Burnham out, backing future Burnham up there. I thought that was actually really cool. It made me want to go back and rewatch the episodes and kind of recontextualize her a little bit with that knowledge. Because it's kind of dark, to say that, I would do the math and I would sacrifice myself if in the situation she's describing. And I don't know. I thought that was a touching and moving little scene.
Yeah. And it'll be interesting to watch season one with this episode in mind and context, because these events, they have to take place between episodes 3 and 4, right? Cause it's after Michael is on the ship. So it's clearly after context is for Kings, but then the next episode after that, Landry is killed by the tardigrade. In The Butcher's Knife Cares Not for the Lamb's Cry, right? So it has to be right in between there, 3 and 4. So I didn't think they had time for an away mission, but apparently they did, because we know that Lorca and Saru and Landry are gone.
Yeah.
Talking about how they do a good job ratcheting up the stakes and having an escalation of the stakes in the third act. So not only is the time bug shielded, but we got a way to bypass the time bug shield, but oh shit. Season one, Michael Burnham woke up and went and recruited season one Reese, and now they're coming after Rainer and Stamets. Mm-hmm. What do you think of Rainer having to be the one to step up and talk season one Burnham down? It's that was the one person that Captain Burnham, she couldn't charm her, she couldn't captain herself. She could get everyone else on the disco to get in line behind her, but not herself.
Well, what is it? She says, "I'm still stubborn, but in a kind of a different way." Yeah. I think that's a nice bit of insight, and I think it's true. And you can grow and still have elements of stubbornness or any other personality trait. So I thought that was a good observation. But this is one of those points where I was somewhat aware of the contrivance, but did I buy into it emotionally? Yes, I think that was cool to see him forced to tactically. He was forced to show empathy, to connect with another person, to connect with the person he probably wants to connect with. He has been, connecting with Burnham this whole episode and relying on her. And so, yeah, he's seeing a past version of her that's maybe a little bit more vulnerable and hasn't kind of, matured the way she has. And I think he, aside from needing to, I think he wanted to. And I think that sort of made the difference. That's how he was able to persuade her. You can argue it's a little contrived, and it is, but I think it worked. And it's the kind of thing, this, again, I could see Kirk doing this. It reminds me of when Kirk would have one of his speeches when he'd stop them from fighting against, who is it who's making them fight the Klingons in that one episode with swords and shit?
They never give that creature a name, but it's Day of the Dove. I just watched that last night.
The creature in Day of the Dove then. Yeah, like, it reminded me of one of those moments. I was like, that's a cool kind of Captain Kirk moment. So I was very happy with it. Yeah, how about you, Father?
I loved that Rainer was the one to shine in that moment, and I liked him when he, I thought it was like pretty badass, and like he walks straight up to the phaser pointed at his chest. That was a cool move. That was a boss move. Mm-hmm. Almost like go ahead and shoot me. Risky. I don't give a shit. But
yeah,
but he had faith in her. He knew that she would do the right thing. He saw the person that she grows up to be. So
right. And I think he knew enough to rely on that.
And we got some Rainer insight. We don't know his backstory, but he says, like, I lost my family young too. So I'm like, oh, what happened to his family? What was going on during the burn that got his family killed? I want to know these Rainer backstory things.
Well, we found out a little bit about Rainer on that sense, and we also found out, if I'm not mistaken, we didn't know that Maul's family. That or her people, I guess she said, had been that there had been some.
Well, they talked about that a little bit in the last episode. That how the previous Cleveland Booker, her father, like he couldn't get back to her. But yeah, it sounded like it was like much worse conditions than they even described then. Where about like I don't know. It sounded like the Emerald Chain were just using chemical weapons on civilian populations. So.
Yeah. So I like that we're getting these moments. Rainer, definitely a deeper character than Maul. He's had much more time with us.
Let's get to our ending. They break the warp bubble and Rainer ages his hand, but no big deal. Doc can wave a light over it. So, but we get like the conversation in the ready room between Burnham and Rainer that I think you were talking about earlier, Dave. Where there's like a little. They both have like a little give and take and kind of meet in the middle. But I liked it. I thought it was like handled really well. I liked that Burnham just being. I think it's because Rainer showed that he took her orders to heart and kind of the lesson that she was trying to teach him to heart. But and I think because of that, she's comfortable enough saying, like, you have some reasonable concerns. I can see why a leader, would be worried about too much familiarity.
Yeah, she needed to see that he could his great rocky exterior could actually bend a little bit. Earlier in the episode, when he apologized to her briefly in the ready room for kind of really getting shouty kind of in her face and insubordinate, he was only backing off really because he recognized that he had crossed like a formal line, there's nobody in in our sort of quasi-military organization should cross that line. My bad. But this was like an actual from the heart kind of moment for him. And showed how even just in the space of the episode, he had definitely changed at least somewhat.
And communication is hard, and connecting can be hard. And I like that they kind of show here that it took Michael and Rainer both listening to the other one.
Yeah, I imagine that she. I I'm hoping she will have more time to listen to what he has to say in the episodes to come. Find out more. He sounds protective of his past. He's not a guy who likes to show emotional vulnerability. He's not going to talk too deeply about himself. But you know what I would love, Father? I want to see them get drunk, maybe.
down at Red's, like, down at the Ferengi bar.
Yeah, yeah. So I mean, that has a name now. Picard and his son did that. Maybe it's a little too obvious, but I'd like to see them both let down their guard and talk a little bit, and maybe swap some stories about captaining. I think that'd be cool.
Paul Nash in our live audience says, it was such an interesting way to break in a new first officer. He basically got to jack in and experience the history of the ship and crew. I think that was a Matrix reference. You have to explain The Matrix to young kids. Apparently, it's like a super hated movie. It is so dated. It is like so like it has the people move like rubbery CGI effects and like the fashion, like the trench coats and the sunglasses. And it's like very like late 90s. It just like it doesn't age well to like young kids apparently hate that movie. I was shocked to learn that.
I think they aren't trying it. I think they think it's like this is Gen X shit and they don't want it. They don't want to play with it. But anyway. Paul Nash, though, great point that it's like, it's one thing to hear about the crew. It's quite another to experience them that way. And, you know, again, work alongside Stamets and Burnham, see, you know, the stakes at work here, see a moment of their battle with control, which, by the way, I did think it was, I kind of like the understated, slightly humorous Burnham saying, like, yeah, that was a tough one, or something like that. I don't know what my point
was. I didn't like that line because to me it was like, oh yeah, that was like a really like big deal when it happened. And I was like, that was one of my least favorite things of the show that I generally like.
I think Fothery, I took it almost a little bit ironically, like a little meta, as if she was like that was a tough plot point, like that was a difficult episode, and not like super sincere of her. And so I think that's why I kind of liked it. I almost felt like they were just taking a little bit of a jab at it. I don't know, but that was kind of how it played to me anyway.
Oh, I don't think so. I think they were like, oh yeah, that was like a big epic battle that like, yeah, it was a tough one.
But... yeah, they didn't worry too much about like getting, you know, hurt in the ship. Aaron says in the comments, he thinks it was totally meta. I'm going to have to look at it again. It's just, that was my gut reaction.
So before we get into the Gorn eggs, the way that the episode ends where, okay, they lost 6 hours and now they are no longer in the lead. Maul and Locke have taken the lead going into season 5, episode 5 next week. Dave, how do you feel about that?
That's fun. It's how you do cliffhangers, like these kind of, these race around the world, or race to get the treasure, or race to get the whatever, is sometimes the bad guys got to take the lead. It's exciting. Good job on them, but I have reconsidered them now and finding them slightly less Bonnie and Clyde, and again, slightly more natural born killers. Because they killed a bad person. I'm okay with that in my fiction anyway.
Yeah, I mean, they killed someone who's like, who sold weapons to be used on civilians, so.
Right. But it was more like their reaction was very blasé about it. And then that chrono bug thing was like, that was a real problem. That was like, that could have taken our people out, and they could have sold them out to the weapons to the Breen and fucked the Federation forever. So... They've ratcheted up in their threat level. Not necessarily I don't necessarily think they're evil or anything, but their
threat level they want us to both like kind of like them, but also like be scared of them, like take them seriously, you know, it's kind of a fine line to balance, you know, because you don't want them, you don't want them to be toothless. You want them to still be scary threats and intimidating opposition for our heroes.
And for me, it's working. What about you, Father? Are you still on board Locke and Maul? Or?
Yes, but I'm really ready for some more substance with them. So I'm hoping next week. I would love if we got like an episode where it's like majority their perspective. I know these episodes are kind of precious with only 6 remaining, and that's all we're going to get of Discovery. So, you know, I love that we're giving beautiful send-offs to a lot of these characters. I think Saru got a great episode in episode 2. I think Dr. Kolber got a great episode last week. I think Anthony Rapp as Stamets really shined a lot this week. But I would be very happy if we got an episode that largely followed the two of them. Or maybe we'll see what they were doing during the 6 hours that the Discovery was busy. I think that would be
that'd be fun.
Or at least maybe like the first half of the episode next week, if it's like that or something like that. Or maybe like we finally get to see, you know, Maul as like a little kid. Or maybe like we finally learn something about Locke. I think I'm really ready for it next week. So that's all I got. So I'm ready for the Gorn egg section if you are.
Yeah, let's hatch them.
Cool. So we got some good ones this week, but these are the Easter eggs and jokes and continuity connections in the episode we thought were worth mentioning. Starting with the title of the episode, Face the Strange, those are actually lyrics from the David Bowie song Changes.
I had not known that until I saw Joel mention it in our comments tonight.
Yeah, so
it passed me by.
We've had a lot of Bowie references in Discovery, so I think David Bowie needs to be like the official, just, or I guess unofficial soundtrack of Discovery. I'm going to associate disco with Bowie music going forward.
He's the star man.
I mentioned how seeing the ship in multiple different time periods over the course of the lifespan of the entire TV show was very similar to the Voyager episode Shattered. Speaking of Star Trek Voyager, the Goblin Man weapons dealer at the beginning, he's actually a member of the Inari species. They were shown in the Voyager episode Nightingale. That's the one where, if you ever want to see, like, Ensign Harry in command, he got to command, like, that medical ship, the Nightingale, Kralor, they were at war with the Inari, but yeah, I like seeing Delta Quadrant species active in the galaxy in the 32nd century. Very cool to see that. Yet even more Voyager references. The time bug was actually a Krynom weapon. So this was the thing that made me say, hot damn, I love season 5 of Star Trek Discovery. And, you know, not only have we gotten, like, a lot of good episodes that are just, I think, entertaining pieces of television that are well-made and well-crafted, but this is really great use of the Star Trek universe. And I just love that, oh yeah, this new piece of media that I got today, it had the Krynom time bug, and that gave me, like, a little piece of lore in one line that not only made me really respect this bad guy weapon that's at play in this episode and consider it, you know, something to fear, but I love getting the confirmation that the Krynom were active in the Temporal War. They were probably, like, some of the big badass. We don't know who all, I guess, all the major players in the Temporal War was. I don't know if I ever needed it explained. I kind of like it being mysterious. And then whenever you need something from the Temporal War, you can, you know, come up with, like, the Krynom time bug or something. But I thought that the Krynom being involved in the Temporal War was a fun contribution to add to the Star Trek chronology.
Referencing that Voyager episode, Joel in the comments says, Red Foreman equals Red Directive.
Yeah, maybe that's where it came from. Saru's line that we hear on the ship, this is Commander Saru, all decks prepare for impact. That was actually said by Doug Jones in the episode Far From Home. So I don't think any of the stuff with Doug Jones, they recorded or shot, like, any new footage. It was all just existing stuff. Zora is still jamming out to the classics. I know this time it is a Que Sera Sera, the song Whatever May Be. Well, I guess it's a song about, like, we're not meant to know the future. Don't worry about it. Whatever is going to happen is going to happen. So that's kind of funny when you're, like, the dark timeline of, like, here's, like, the bad stuff that's going to happen. But yeah, I guess, like, whatever timeline, Zora is going to go cuckoo and listen to 20th century music and watch, like, Audrey Hepburn movies or Charlie Chaplin or listen to some Doris Day. I think they're also connecting this with, you know, her ability to dream in season 4 as the explanation for Calypso. I think the short trek Calypso takes place during this time period. I think that's why it explains why the ship Discovery has its old seasons 1 and 2 appearance, but yet it's supposed to be, like, thousands or 1,000 years in the future. And I don't know. I think that was just all something, like, she was dreaming in this time. And that's why when she sees Michael, she's like, oh, I thought you were a dream I was having. I thought you were another dream. So, but maybe that, I don't know. Maybe they'll someday tell us that Calypso is something else, but I think they're never going to say anything else on it. And this is the best we're going to get to close the book on Calypso. So
I bet that's right.
But I'm okay with that. The Breen attack on Starfleet HQ, that made me chuckle because the Breen did the exact same thing in Deep Space Nine. They were known as, like, the only people who had ever pulled that off. So I like that they're like, we did it once, we're going to do it again. And then Burnham on the bridge during the time of Lorca's discovery was really cool. Not only do we get to bring back Bryce and Arium, but they had Hannah Chessman playing Arium, and they had Julian Grossman came back to do the voice of the computer. Before it turned into Zora, they had Julian Grossman doing the computer voice. So we got, like, that one line. There are two identical sets of Michael Burnham, one is presently unconscious. Like, that was the old voice.
That's cool. What a neat little touch.
And Tilly complimenting Michael's braids, that was a great touch, because when the first scene they have together in season 3, Tilly compliments Michael's new hair. So that was really good continuity.
She was always destined to like it.
I mean, that made perfect sense, though. Like, if the person, like, when they first see this haircut on this person, they're like, oh, that looks good on you. Like, that made sense. Like, that would repeat. And it was a very subtle thing that I think a lot of people wouldn't notice. Mm-hmm. I love that. I love that little stuff like that.
Tilly gonna Tilly.
And of course, the last time we saw a Starfleet captain super age his hand, it was Jean-Luc Picard in the TNG episode Timescape. So that's all I got on Gorn eggs. But Dave, if we got like 2 minutes left, if you have any subspace transmissions from last week's episode, Janal, what are people saying about that?
Sure. Let's see. On Twitter, Linz says, I really enjoyed Rainer, and also Wilson Cruz was brilliant. Geek in Review said it was Side Quest Central. Over on Discord, Joel said that Janal is major Curzon vibes. Definitely can see that. Burnham is meditating with both hands in the live long and prosper position. That is new. Is that new? I wasn't sure.
I didn't notice that she was doing that.
Definitely was. I for sure noticed it. I just wasn't sure. It didn't ring a bell as something.
Spock meditates on his knees like that in Wrath of Khan, I think, when he's like hanging out in his room in his robe.
Yeah, it was definitely like the, okay. I can't suddenly do it, but yeah, it was like that. One other one, let me mention, over on YouTube, I like this comment from Opinions No One Cares About, said, Reno's the fun aunt of their little family, and I love it.
The fun aunt. I like that too. Yeah, she's the fun aunt for sure. I'm looking forward to next week's episode. It's called Mirrors, and I know a lot of people get tired of the time travel, but I like Star Trek time travel. I also like Star Trek Mirror Universe, and maybe we'll have Mirror Universe next week. It's called Mirrors, I don't know, but Michelle Paradise gave us a tease for it. She gave us a tease for every episode, and on next week she says something interesting that doesn't really say much. She gives a long pause, followed by, I'm trying to think of something that won't be spoilery, surprising encounters, and surprising new information about our heroes. So that's all we know. Some surprises in a week, so Dave and I will talk about it with y'all then, and have another deep dive discussion, and hope everyone comes back, and we'll continue on. I guess we'll be out at our official halfway point of the season then, so.
Yeah, the Wednesday of the season.
But until then, as always, live long and prosper, y'all.
Listen to the Text Trek podcast through Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or at text-trek.com. Like us on Facebook at facebook.com/text-trek, and follow Fathery on Twitter at TXTrek. Please support us by liking our videos and subscribing to our channel on YouTube. Thank you and take care.